Pull up a chair. I want you to imagine the quietest airplane you have ever heard. No engine, no exhaust note, no prop blast tearing at your headset. Just the soft creak of Mylar stretched over foam, the whisper of a big slow propeller turning behind you, and the sound of one man breathing hard. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar, where we spend a little time every day with the stories that made us fall in love with flight in the first place. And today I want to tell you about the morning a bicycle racer with an aeronautical engineering degree pedaled an airplane made of plastic wrap and piano wire across the English Channel. No fuel, no motor, nothing but two legs and a 22-foot propeller. If that sounds impossible, good, because for most of human history it was before we climb in. A quick word from the folks keeping the lights on here at the station. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And I'll tell you, the fellow in today's story earned a coin that nobody had ever handed out before. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's set the scene. For as long as people have watched birds, we have wanted to do what they do, not sit in a machine and let an engine do the work. Actually fly, muscle and wing. That was the dream Icarus chased with wax and feathers, and it's the dream that killed a whole lot of brave, foolish men who jumped off towers with contraptions strapped to their arms, flapping all the way down.
The problem is a cruel one, and it's all about arithmetic. A human being, even a superb athlete, can only put out about a third of one horsepower for any real length of time. A fit cyclist in a sprint might touch a full horsepower for a few seconds, but sustained over an hour, you're talking about a fraction of what the smallest lawnmower engine makes. That is almost nothing. To fly on that, you cannot muscle your way into the air. You have to build an airplane so absurdly efficient, so impossibly light and clean, that a third of a horsepower is enough to keep it up. For decades, nobody could do it. There was a prize on the table, too. Back in the 50s, a British industrialist named Henry Kremer put up money for the first genuine human-powered flight. And the Kremer Prize sat there, and sat there. Teams in England built beautiful, careful, heavy machines out of wood and fabric, and they would stagger into the air for a few hundred yards and settle back down, exhausted. The prize money kept growing because nobody could claim it. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Enter a Californian named Paul McCready. And McCready was not a bicycle man, and he was not really an airplane manufacturer. He was a soaring pilot. A glider man. National soaring champion, in fact, and one of the sharpest minds in the business of flying with no engine at all. He understood in his bones how a wing sips energy out of thin air. And the story goes that McCready got interested in this human-powered problem for the least romantic reason imaginable. He had co-signed a loan for a relative. The deal went bad, and he owed the bank a pile of money. It happened to be almost exactly the amount of that Kremer prize. So he sat down to solve a math problem to pay off a debt, and the way he solved it changed everything.
Everybody before him had built airplanes, real airplanes, sleek and stiff and heavy, the way you're supposed to. McCready looked at it differently. He said, "Forget sleek, forget fast. I want the slowest, lightest, most fragile thing that will still fly, and I want to be able to fix it with tape in the parking lot when I break it. Because I'm going to break it. A lot." His first machine was called the Gossamer Condor, and it did not look like an airplane. It looked like a giant dragonfly built by a kid out of drinking straws and saran wrap. A huge wing 90-some feet across, wider than a lot of airliners, but weighing next to nothing. Aluminum tubes, piano wire bracing, and that skin, that shimmering skin, was Mylar. The same thin plastic film they use for party balloons, stretched drum tight over the ribs. The pilot sat in a little pod down below, cranking pedals that turned a big lazy propeller. In 1977, the Gossamer Condor flew a figure-eight course around two markers a half mile apart, and it won that first Kremer Prize. The debt was paid. First true human-powered flight in history. That Condor now hangs in the Smithsonian, right there in Washington, and if you've never stood under it, put it on your list. It doesn't look like it should hold up a house cat, let alone a grown man. But McCready wasn't done, because old Henry Kremer, bless him, put up a second prize, a bigger one. This one was for real distance. Fly a human-powered airplane across the English Channel, from England to France, over open, cold salt water. Better than 22 miles of it. 22 miles on a third of a horsepower. That's the whole ballgame right there.
So McCready and his team built the next airplane. They called it the Gossamer Albatross, and it was a refinement of everything they'd learned. They'd moved on from aluminum tubes to carbon fiber, which back in 1979 was exotic, cutting-edge stuff. Carbon fiber spars wrapped and cured by hand,
the whole wing spanning about 96 feet, nearly the span of a Boeing 727, and yet the entire airplane, empty, weighed about 70 pounds. 70 pounds, you could pick it up. You could, honest to God, pick the whole airplane up and carry it, and it would flex and bow in your hands like it was breathing. Now they needed an engine, and by engine I mean a man. His name was Brian Allen. And Brian Allen was the perfect creature for this job. He was a bicycle racer, a genuinely elite endurance athlete, but he was also an amateur hang glider pilot and a fellow who understood the sky. He was light, he was lean, and he had a heart and a set of lungs that could just keep going and going and going.
He starts to pedal. The airplane doesn't leap into the air. Nothing about this is violent. It just gathers itself, and the big prop bites, and the wing starts to carry, and he lifts off the beach and out over the water. And now the loneliest part of aviation begins. He is flying at maybe 5 feet off the water, sometimes 10. He has to stay low, right down in what we call ground effect, that cushion of air near the surface where a wing flies more efficiently, because he needs every scrap of efficiency he can steal. So he's skimming the wave tops close enough to touch, pedaling at a cadence he has to hold for hours, and the coast of England is falling away behind him, and the coast of France is nowhere in sight, just gray water in every direction and the sound of his own breathing inside that bubble. And it started to go wrong almost right away. Now here's the thing they'd worried about. This airplane had no reserves, none, on the practice flights. The plan had been for maybe an hour of flying, but the winds that morning turned against him. What should have been a push became a fight. His airspeed over the water dropped, the crossing that was supposed to take an hour was stretching out, and Brian Allen is burning through everything he's got. He's dehydrating. In that plastic bubble, the air gets hot and close, and he can't carry much water because water is weight, and weight is the enemy. His drinking water runs low, his legs are filling up with lactic acid, that deep burning ache any cyclist knows, except he cannot coast, he cannot stop. Because the instant he stops pedaling, the airplane comes down into the sea. There is no gliding this thing to safety. The engine is his legs, and if the engine quits, he's swimming. And the radio, he had a little radio link to the boats following him, and partway across it failed. So now he's also cut off, alone in a bubble over the channel, legs screaming, mouth dry, and he can't even talk to the people who came to help him. There's a chase boat, and MacCready's team is out there on the water watching, and at one point it looks like it's over. Brian is spent, he's flying lower and lower as his strength fades, down toward the wave tops, and they bring a boat in close to try to snag the airplane before it goes in the drink, and is destroyed. They actually reach up with a pole to grab it, and here's the moment. Here's the moment that makes this a flying story and not just an engineering story. Brian Allen, down to almost nothing, looks up, and he finds a little pocket of smoother, cooler air just a bit higher, and he decides he's not done. He digs into a reserve that I don't think any of us can really imagine, and he climbs. He climbs the airplane back up, away from the boat, away from the sea, out of the reach of that rescue pole, and he keeps pedaling, because somewhere out ahead of him finally is a smudge on the horizon,
and the smudge is France. The last stretch, he's flying on fumes, human fumes. 2 hours and 49 minutes he was in the air. Nearly 3 hours of holding a bicycle sprint that most of us couldn't hold for 10 minutes, over cold water, in a machine held together with tape and prayer. And at long last the beach at Cap Grisnez comes up under that gossamer wing, the coast of France, and Brian Allen brings the gossamer albatross down onto the sand. He'd done it, 22 and a half miles England to France, on nothing but his own two legs. The first human being in all of history to cross the English Channel under his own muscle power in the air. He'd flown across the same water that Louis Blériot crossed in a powered monoplane, exactly 70 years before, in 1909, and he'd done it with no engine at all. Just a man, a wing, and a will, that would not quit. That flight won the second Kremer Prize, £100,000, the biggest prize in aviation at the time. But you know, I don't think Brian Allen was thinking about the money when his wheels touched that French sand. I think he was thinking about breathing.
Now let me tell you why this matters. Because it's easy to file this under stunt and move on, don't. That gossamer approach, that idea of building something so light and so efficient that a whisper of power could sustain it, that didn't die on the beach in France. Paul McCready took those exact lessons and went on to build the Solar Challenger, an airplane that flew across the English Channel on nothing but sunlight falling on its wings. And then his company AeroVironment went on to build some of the first serious solar-powered, ultralight, high-altitude aircraft, machines that could stay up on sunlight for days. The whole modern world of electric flight and solar aircraft, and these featherweight long-endurance drones, a real piece of that traces straight back to a soaring champion who needed to pay off a bank loan and decided the answer was to build the lightest flying machine anybody had ever seen. And there's a lesson in there for us too. The ones who fly with engines and AVGAs and all the noise, McCready won by respecting how little he had to work with. He didn't try to overpower the problem. He honed the airplane until the problem got small enough to solve. Every one of us who has ever milked a glider up in a thermal, or stretched a glide to the numbers with the engine at idle, or flown a light airplane on a budget, knows a little piece of that truth. Efficiency is its own kind of power. The birds figured that out a long time ago. It took us a while to catch up. The Gossamer Albatross, by the way, the original, is hanging today in the Smithsonian's collection, and there was a backup airplane that's been shown at museums over the years, too. If you ever get the chance to stand under one of those wings, do it. Look at how thin that skin is. Look at how little there is holding it together, and then try to imagine pedaling that thing for 3 hours over the cold gray channel, with your radio dead and your legs on fire, and choosing when the boat came alongside to save you, to climb instead.
That's the story. My thanks to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, whose records on the Gossamer aircraft keep the details straight, and to Paul McCready and Brian Allen themselves, who told this tale plenty of times over the years and never made it sound as impossible as it truly was. If you want to see photos of these beautiful, ridiculous airplanes, go poke around radiohanger.com when you get a minute. It's worth it. I'm Tail Dragger. Next time somebody tells you an airplane needs an engine to be a real airplane, you tell them about the morning a man flew to France on a plastic wing and a pair of tired legs. See you next time.